Praise the Lord, everyone. This is Dr. Michael Morris, again, of For God's Glory Ministries, coming to you with Bible study on CD. This is Bible study session number 115, and we're going to be looking again at the book of the Revelation, chapters 2 and 3, the historical perspective or interpretation of the letter to the churches. So this is part 2 on that subject. We're going to have 5 questions on our quiz for this session. And of course, it will be covering our previous session, Bible study number 114. Question number 1. This is a true-false question. The historical interpretation of the letters to the churches comes as a direct result of John's comments on the subject in the book of the Revelation. Is that true or false? The answer is false. Question number 2. The church at Pergamos represented the Dark Ages. Is that true or false? The answer is false. Question number 3. The era of the blank church ended with the Edict of Toleration. The answer is Smyrna. Question number 4. This is a multiple choice question. Which of these was not a key feature in Constantine's Edict of Toleration? So there are 5 things I'm going to mention here, and you are to point out the one thing that is not a key feature or was not a key feature in Constantine's Edict of Toleration. A, changing the Sabbath from Saturday to Sunday. B, restoring Christian property. C, freedom of worship for Christians. D, corporate recognition and rights for the Christian church. And E, expected blessings from the Christian God. So which one of these is not or was not a key feature in Constantine's Edict of Toleration? I'll name them quickly again for you. A, changing the Sabbath from Saturday to Sunday. B, restoring Christian property. C, freedom of worship. D, corporate recognition and rights. And E, expected blessings from the Christian God. The answer is A, changing the Sabbath from Saturday to Sunday. This was not a feature of the Edict of Toleration. And then finally, number 5. The Catholic Inquisition and the Crusades occurred during the 1,000-year period in history called the Blank Ages. This was represented by which of the 7 churches? So we're looking for 2 separate answers here. The Catholic Inquisition and the Crusades occurred during a 1,000-year period in history called the Blank Ages. This period was represented by which of the 7 churches? The answers are the Middle Ages or the Dark Ages, and it was represented by the church at Thyatira. Alrighty, well, I hope you did great on the quiz, and hopefully you're ready to go right into our study of the second part of our historical interpretation, or our look at the historical interpretation of the book of Revelation, chapter 2 and 3, with the letters to the churches. So what I'm going to be doing now is spending some time giving you an appropriate context in order to properly not only digest the subject matter for the latter three churches, but also to come to some conclusions about the meaning of these letters to the churches from a historical perspective. Okay, now, as you may recall, the next church on John's list was Sardis. Now, this church was judged as looking good on the outside, but lacking true spiritual substance internally. So, the first thing that I will point out is pretty much everyone accepts that looks at this historical foreshadowing and believes in it as being a message intended by God to us, pretty much agrees that the letter to Sardis would represent the period of the Protestant Reformation. Now, what you'll find is that the period that is usually attached to this is the period between 1517 and 1800. And so obviously that whole time was not the Reformation itself, but the Reformation starts this period, and then this period passes on all the way to 1800. Now, of course, these time frames are arbitrary to some extent, but up to this point on our first four churches, we've been able to fairly simply and fairly easily divide these time periods up. Now, it will be more challenging here in this session, and you can look at this session this way. There is the time period attached to the church at Sardis. That is an issue unto itself. Certainly, it's possible that we could be in the Sardis period as this goes. However, very few people want to be known as being part of the Sardis period, and I suppose it's not too much of a stretch to attach the time period that already has been given for it to the Sardis church. But nonetheless, it will be important for us to ascertain, you know, what church are we talking about here? What aspect of the church, etc., should be attached to this period? And then the other aspect to this session will be Philadelphia and Laodicea. That gets us much more likely contemporary with our lives here on earth right now. And so then it becomes much more difficult to draw those hard lines. Okay. So again, we're talking about the Sardis period and then separately the Philadelphia and Laodicean period. So I'm going to be sharing with you a fair amount of background information to help you with this historical interpretation. Now, what we're going to be delving into is the church itself. We know that God, through John, wrote this letter to the churches. And if we are to believe that each letter represents a period, then for this particular period, where the indictment is that the church appears to be spiritually thriving on the outside, or certainly looks good from the outside, but is clearly wanting from a spiritual substance standpoint internally. So we will be figuring out, well, okay, since he's talking about the church, you know, what is the church at this point? And this comes to mind because the church at this stage is not a monolith. It wasn't previously. We left out the Eastern Orthodox Church and focused on, at the last time, pretty much exclusively on the Catholic Church. And that was entirely appropriate. That was the dominant force in Western culture at that time, which dominated everything. However, at this point, it's going to be more important to be inclusive. It's going to be more important to paint the full picture of Christendom on this session. So now, first of all, the Roman or the Catholic Church has indeed been the main focal point, not only of our discussions, but of Christendom in general, for nearly all of Christian history, and certainly up to the point of the Lutheran Reformation. Now, despite this fact, the Catholic hold on the church in the East was quite loose throughout all of its period when the Roman Empire dominated. And so the Eastern part of the church is what I want to educate you some about. We've touched on it briefly in other areas, but we're going to get much more into it now. So the Eastern part of the church, which is also known as the Eastern Orthodox Church, or sometimes called the Greek Orthodox Church. Now, this church has always been culturally somewhat different and had a different slant and approach from that of the Western or Latin church, the Catholic Church. Now, remember, Catholic means general or all-inclusive. And so, of course, the Catholic Church feels like they are the church. They describe themselves as the mother church. Okay, but we're talking about the Eastern Orthodox Church now. Now, this schism between the Catholic Church and what became the Eastern Orthodox Church, this actually became a political reality, an actual reality, when Constantine decided to have the capital of the Roman Empire to move it to Constantinople from Rome and to make his home there. Now, there were still Roman bishops who were assigned to all of the areas through Rome at that time. But again, as I mentioned, the ties were loose. And remember that the Bishop of Rome ultimately grew into the office of the Pope. And from an official standpoint, this office of the Roman bishop or the Pope had supremacy, particularly in regards to the Catholic Church, and would claim official supremacy, if not practical supremacy, in regards to the Eastern Orthodox churches. From the Western end, the Pope position continues to today to have supremacy over matters regarding the Catholic Church. So the Eastern Orthodox Church, that is the most accurate term, even though there are other terms, as I mentioned before. And the reason it's the most accurate is because it's actually made up of several regional churches. So to call it the Greek Orthodox isn't quite fair. However, the Eastern Orthodox, or some people shorten it to the Orthodox Church, is a fairly accurate term. Now, the major churches that make up this Orthodox Church are ones of the Greek Orthodox Church, Russian Orthodox Church, the Bulgarian Orthodox Church, the Church of Alexandria, or the Orthodox Church, Eastern Orthodox Church of Alexandria, and that is Alexandria, Egypt, and the Church of Jerusalem, and finally rounding it out, the Orthodox Church in America. Now, by the way, the bishop of the Eastern Orthodox Church of Alexandria is actually the same bishop. That bishop controls all or governs the affairs of all of the Eastern Orthodox affairs in Africa. And so whichever bishop or patriarch of the Eastern Orthodox Church in Alexandria, or wherever that person lives or is based, that is the base for the Eastern Orthodox Church, for Africa. Now, this position, which is like a papal position, it's like a pope, and sometimes it's called a pope, the Eastern Orthodox Church says that this succeeded down through the lineage and from the Apostle Mark. They would call him Mark the Evangelist. And this is the same John Mark that was a nephew of Barnabas and traveled with Barnabas and Paul, the same Mark that is credited with authoring Mark the Gospel. So now, just as Constantine, and excuse me, just as the Catholic Church has its Pope position and claims to have the lineage from St. Peter, the Eastern Orthodox folks claim the same thing vis-a-vis Mark the Evangelist, as they call him. So now the Patriarch of Constantinople has the honor of primacy. So it's like the Pope, the overall presiding Pope of the Eastern Orthodox Church or the Orthodox Church. And some people drop off the East because of the movement to the West in the United States, etc. But I think you get the point at this stage. So now this Patriarch of Constantinople, again, is similar to the papal position, but it doesn't carry the same authority that the Catholic Church invests in its Pope. It is it's a figurehead position, and there is some additional power associated with it, but it's nowhere near like the Catholic Church. The divisions of power are much more decentralized in the Eastern Orthodox Church. So now, as far as religious authority, in the Eastern Orthodox Christian Church, it is not the Pope, as in Catholicism, that has the religious authority, nor is it, as in Protestantism, the individual with his or her Bible that takes on religious authority, but rather the scriptures are interpreted by seven ecumenical councils of the Orthodox Church. So that gives you some idea as to how these three key branches of Christianity are broadly different or differed or rather distinguished. So again, you have the Catholic Church headed by, if you will, and represented by the Pope. Protestantism, by definition, focuses more on the individual's relationship with God directly and ability to learn from the Bible on their own. And then you have the Eastern Orthodox Church, which is more decentralized than the Catholic Church, but certainly not as individual-based as the Protestant Church, having the seven ecumenical councils decide how the scriptures ought to be interpreted and lived out. Now, the very loose connection between the Catholic or the Western Church and the Eastern Orthodox Church was severed in 1054 AD when Pope Leo IX excommunicated the Patriarch of Constantinople. Now, in response to that excommunication, the Patriarch of Constantinople condemned the Pope, and the church was formally divided at that time and has been ever since. So these were the only two notable factions of the Christian church until the 1530s, which is when the Anglican church was born. So think of it as the Eastern Orthodox Church and the Catholic Church at that point. And we fast forward to the 1530s. So we have the Anglican Church born at this time. Now, this Anglican Church was also born out of Roman Catholicism. That's important to understand. Now, most in the United States would say that the Anglican Church was born as a result of King Henry VIII's desire to divorce his wife and to remarry. And he was, of course, refused by the Pope, as we all know. Now, most Westerners would say that he did this in order to have his way. And so, since the Pope wouldn't let him have his way, he started his own church, the Church of England, or the Anglican Church. So, the name Anglican just means England. So, the Anglicans now, they of course, have a different view on its own history and origins. They attach the origin much more to the Lutheran Reformation. They would say that the papal authority had been challenged for quite some time at that point, and that Henry VIII just formalized the split when he dissolved the monasteries and the abbeys in 1536. All right, so while we're talking about the Anglican Church, let's talk about some of the what we now think of as denominations that came out of the Anglican Church. Something that many people don't quite know or realize is that the Episcopal Church was founded as a result of English exploration and colonization in North America. It comes out of the Anglican Church. Now, there did get to be an aspect of the Episcopal Church that was much more Protestant in nature, and the actual Protestant Episcopal Church began its separate existence in 1789. Now, another one that I'll mention is the Methodist Church, which clearly is identified with Protestantism. It's thought of being a Protestant denomination. But this church actually also was born in the 1700s based on the teachings of John Wesley. So it also, again, has its roots in Anglicanism. Now, if you think of Anglicanism as a separate branch of the Catholic Church, then clearly these denominations would have more directly arisen out of Catholicism. However, if you, as many of the Anglicans do, identify its origins with the Lutheran Reformation, then you would see it as more of a Protestant denomination. So I just wanted to touch on those things as far as Anglicanism is concerned that not everybody would necessarily know. So now back to the Reformation. So before there was an Episcopal Church, or even an Anglican Church for that matter, Martin Luther's campaign resulted in the Lutheran Church or denomination. This Reformation originated in Germany. And as this reform movement spread to places like Switzerland, this led to Presbyterianism, or as we know as the Presbyterian Church. And this was in large came out of the teachings of John Calvin, as many of you, I'm sure, know. Switzerland was also the birthplace of the Anabaptists, the spiritual ancestors of today's Amish, the Mennonites, the Quakers, as well as the Baptists. So the Baptists go back to the early 1600s, and the most notable name associated with the origins of the Baptist Church is John Smith, spelled with a Y. All right, with that, I think you should have a pretty clear picture of Christendom as it stood in about 1800. All right, now, armed with the knowledge of the major developments in the church during this period, the Sardis period, you're now in a position to evaluate the merits of this historical interpretation of the letters to the churches, and in specific, the Church of Sardis in this case. Now, remember that they were judged to have the outward appearance and the reputation of being alive, but on the inside were in actuality not alive, but dead, with only a remnant yet alive. So now it's left to us to summarize or to assess what was dead and what was the remnant that was indeed alive, although nearly dead. Now, some will say that this is a judgment of the Catholic Church, actually many, and in Protestantism, frankly, most say that this is a judgment of the Catholic Church. Others, especially Catholics, would say that it's an indictment of the church as a whole, and actually most devout Catholics would say that they were the remnant that was yet alive, and it was the Protestant church that was the dead church that seemed alive. Well, either argument has good reason on the surface. And at this time of relative decline in power and stature of the Catholic Church and questions regarding the position of Pope or papacy, the Catholic Church could definitely be a strong candidate. And there's no doubt that the Protestant Church was full of activity and growing rapidly during this period. There was certainly the sense that this part of the church, the Protestant Church, was indeed alive. And no matter who it represents, if any, no one wants to be the dead part of the church, the part that Jesus judged as being dead. And everybody wants to be the part that is the remnant that is yet alive in this case. Now, there's one thing to keep in mind in this situation here is that there were indeed those at that time that were convinced that Jesus' return was imminent. And so from this historical interpretation, they would have to have been thinking that they were in the remnant. They likely viewed themselves as being either this remnant that was alive, or even more likely, they probably interpreted themselves as being part of the Philadelphia church. Now, again, this is not saying that that's what they were thinking, but if indeed they accepted this historical interpretation of the letters to the churches, then they would indeed very likely have been seeing themselves as a minimum as this remnant, and more likely as the Philadelphia church. And also, I would point out that in view of end times thinking, end times scenarios, where the world is coming to a close, of all of the people that have been thought of as the Antichrist, the Pope has been tops on the list for a very long time. So this Sardis period saw a relative decline in the Catholic Church and the emergence of and maturation of the Protestant Church with its various denominations, as well as the offshoots of the Anglican Church as well. So needless to say, most feel that the Catholic Church was dead on arrival to the Sardis period. And it seemed as though the Protestant Church was the remnant that still had some life within it. And so, on that note, we move on to the next church on the list, the Philadelphia Church. And if you think the Sardis Church creates some controversy in its historical discussion, it only gets tougher here. Let me explain why this is the case. First of all, if you believe that the historical hidden message is indeed for real, then you are sure of two things for certain. Number one, the last church will have the characteristics of the Laodicean church. And number two, the church before that will have the characteristics of Philadelphia. And of course, no one wants to be Laodicea. And everybody wants to be Philadelphia. All right, so it's a given that everybody wants to be Philadelphia. Nobody wants to be Laodicea. That's understandable. But it's at this point that things get more complicated, but also somewhat more interesting. In order to be a part of the Philadelphia church and to assure ourselves that we are not part of the Laodicean church, there must be a definitive cutoff point between the two. You see, it's very easy for us to look back and to dice up the past into easy and even convenient little chunks, because hindsight is 20/20. But Christians of all eras, no matter what they felt, have had to struggle with and deal with their present time. It's even easier to point to the future than to substantiate the present, because nobody can prove you wrong about the future. Everybody's brilliant when it comes to the future. But the present is always much more challenging because any evidence is there for all to see and to question. Now, first of all, in keeping with the eras as we've presented them, as they've been historically described in Christian studies, this one here, the Philadelphian era, begins in about 1800 or so. But regardless of when it started, if we feel that we are now part of the Philadelphia church, that period is not Sardis and not Laodicea. If that's the case, then that brings the Philadelphia church to the present. And so the Philadelphia-Laodicea dividing line becomes more important. It's not as important if we believe we're in Philadelphia. It's not as important when Sardis, the Sardis period ended and when Philadelphia began. It's not relevant. If we are still in the Philadelphian period, though, to distinguish ourselves from Laodicea, we need a dividing line. Well, the convenient landmark here is the rapture. Easy. If you believe in the pre-tribulation rapture of the church, then everything falls neatly into place for you here. The church in Philadelphia was described as having little strength, having kept the Lord's word and not denied his name. The Lord goes on to say about this church that because they have kept the word in patience, he will keep them from the hour of temptation, which shall come upon all the world to try them that dwell upon the earth. So, of course, the rapture coming and rescuing a faithful church from the tribulation to come fits the pre-tribulation rapture belief to a T. Oh, and wouldn't it be great if in reality it were that simple? But now there's so much that I want to say about this subject, but instead I'm going to point out just a few things. Maybe it'll seem like a lot to you, but it's a few things to me that indeed come to mind. Now, most of us, that is those who teach or preach about biblical issues, don't really get into this subject very much. And that's because it's simply easier for us to accept this very logical and convenient conclusion that we are in the last days and we're part of that wonderful Philadelphian church that Jesus will rescue any minute, rapture us away so we don't have to go through that terrible tribulation. And I suppose that anyone naturally would want things to be that way. But there's just a few things lacking in this very tidy and convenient conclusion. First of all, the Philadelphia church was of little strength, not the very influential, bloated, wealthy, puffed up, and really proud institution that we recognize in the West, and in particular, the United States. And although the U.S. is not all of Christendom, there's no question, I'm sure some of you thought about that when I said that, general biblical statements or comments have always referred to the dominant power and influence of the time, whether it's secular or religious. It's always referred, general statements, to the dominant institution of the time. Now, number two, the Philadelphian church toiled under very adverse circumstances. And that's why their fidelity to the Lord's word was so significant. Clearly, the Western church cannot claim to identify with this. There are Christians in the world, no doubt, that are indeed toiling under very tough conditions. Those who are living under those conditions as Christians many under threat of persecution, etc., having to hide their worship and all that. They certainly fit more into the descriptions and the lifestyle and the circumstances of many of these churches, and including the Philadelphian church. But these comments are made to the general, more dominant whole. So we can't use that as an out. The Philadelphian church was described differently from what we know, certainly, in the United States. And even if we use that as an out, then, that makes us here in the more affluent, comfortable church not the church that he's talking to. And that takes us right out of being the Philadelphia church. Don't think you want that. Now, thirdly, most teachers, preachers, and scholars that believe in a pre-tribulation rapture say that the church will be removed from the earth at that instant. That sounds really great. We're part of the church. We're gone. Now this terrible world, they're going to see, they're going to get their just desserts, and we are out of here, right? The church has been removed. That protective presence has been removed. That sounds good if you're one of those being removed, I'm sure. So we're gone in an instant, in a moment, in a twinkling of an eye, where there is no doubting that this event will indeed occur at some point. But if we equate this event with a pre-tribulation rapture, then we're describing a church that is left behind, that is entirely composed of previously unsaved people. And so at this point, this Laodicean church, this post-tribulation church, if you will, is made up of a church that is devoid of those that have been taken in the rapture. And therefore, somehow, is to go on forward despite having no truly saved members as a part of it. Now, this aspect, to some extent, does square with the Laodicean letter, in that there is no mention in the description of the church at Laodicea of any remnant, of any small number of folks that were not included in this bloated, indifferent, luxury-laden church. And so that part does indeed square fairly well. Not that all parts do, but this aspect certainly does. And so fourthly, the fourth thing that I would like to point out is that the Laodicean church was described as a commercially preoccupied, very materially successful entity who, because of its own blindness, was its own worst enemy. Remember that? That's what the Laodicean church was described as. So, unfortunately, not only do we not seem to fit real nicely into the description of the Philadelphian church, this poor of little strength church toiling under persecution and living up to God's word despite that. Not only do we not quite fit that description, but unfortunately, we find ourselves eerily similar to this description biblically of the Laodicean church. Blind, but not knowing that they are blind, blissfully indifferent, well-clothed in the natural, but not realizing that they are spiritually naked, wealthy and living in luxury in the natural, but not knowing that they are miserably poor from a pure spiritual standpoint. You can read it again if you'd like, but I'm pretty sure you're not going to come out of it with the Laodicean church going through tribulation. And remember, it was said that the whole world would go through that testing. The church would not be spared that testing and those trials. By definition, that is exactly why the Philadelphian church would be spared that, because no one would be spared, including the church. Now, if you really want to make a stretch, though, and make this fit somehow into a prophecy, what you would have to do, and we haven't gotten to this point, and I'm trying really hard not to get ahead of myself, but if you take the Laodicean church as the tribulation church, and you take the church that's being spoken to as the one that is the church of the Antichrist, the one world religion church that will develop during the tribulation period under the Antichrist and the false prophet, then you actually can say that maybe this matches with the Laodicean church. And those that get saved and literally give their lives as a result of accepting Christ in the tribulation period, they would then be either not part of that church, or they would have to be a part of the church that's not mentioned, or a part of the church of folks that did heed the warning as it's described in the letter to the Laodiceans. So again, my point is that in that sense, maybe we can look at this Laodicean church from a historical perspective as matching with that of the Antichrist. That's the only way you can do it, because you can't describe those Christians that will give their lives as a result of their beliefs that they come to being saved in the tribulation period. You can never match that with the description of the Laodicean church as it's described in the letter. Now, as we prepare to talk about Laodicea, our final church, I'm sure you'll notice that in my discussions of the Philadelphian era or church era, I did mention Laodicea quite a bit, and I feel that it was pretty much inevitable, because the key point to be made there was to distinguish the Philadelphia church from the Laodicean church, and that challenge is put before us because we are living in the current times. We're living in some era now, and if we are to define ourselves and to put ourselves into this historical context and interpretation, we have to get our bearings as to where we are. And so if we believe we're not in the Sardis church, then we've got to be in one of the other two. It was impossible to just talk about the Philadelphia church, because we are not certain, or we are trying to conclude what era we are actually in. And so therefore we know what God is expecting of us or wanting from us. So in this last section, we will be talking about two subjects that are sort of dovetail onto the previous. We will still be talking about where we stand in this time. And then we will also be talking about specifically the Laodicean church. We will begin by touching on Philadelphia, but then moving on to Laodicea specifically. So now, in reality, unfortunately, all of us living in this day and time as Christians, as a whole, we look more like Laodicea and Sardis than we do like Philadelphia. And this is where I'm sure my discussion on this issue would be very unpopular with most Christian circles. That's just the way it is. But the truth has often been unflattering to God's representative institutions and peoples over the course of history. It was the case, no doubt, in the garden. It was the case with the Jewish folk, particularly when Jesus came along. And it is indeed the case with the five churches, with the seven churches, with five of them getting less than stellar evaluations in their letters. And mind you, these were churches that were born in presumably the most pure or apostolic, quote unquote, age. And yet five of them were indicted with some things that they needed to change. But to want to believe the best about yourself or for yourself is human nature. The truth, however, simply is what it is. We can influence people, but we cannot manipulate the outcome of prophecy. God's word cannot fail. Now, before we focus specifically on Laodicea, I'd like to point out one fact, and that is that some would say that the material success of the Catholic Church looks a lot like Laodicea. Now, there is no doubt the Catholic Church has more wealth in it than all of the Protestant denominations put together. There's no question about that. But it doesn't fit on its own as the church that's being spoken of for many reasons. Okay, now for Laodicea. The church characterized by luxurious living, comfort, wealth, and popularity, spiritual indifference, which isn't even noticed on their part. They didn't even realize the state that they were in, but so bad off that God could not even digest them in a spiritual sense. So this church is a church that needs an awakening. Medical and scientific advances available to them, made from the very raw materials that God himself provided mankind, but man taking full credit for every advance and every improvement. But I digress. I'm beginning to describe the secular society. Excuse me. I'm sorry. Forgive me. But am I digressing, really? Or is this secular humanist bug infecting the church, as well as even in some ways coming to define it? Remember that God himself chose to point these things out when describing the church at Laodicea. We all know that church life was going on there just as it is today. Religious ritual, tradition, and activity did not go away. But the Laodicean church became, most of all, spiritually irrelevant. And by the way, even at its worst times, the Catholic Church could never be accused of this. Spiritual arrogance, maybe, corrupt, but never indifferent nor irrelevant. So if we are to give credence to this historical interpretation of the letters to the churches, we ultimately have to conclude that we as Protestant Christians are part of this historical picture today. We certainly cannot use the Catholic Church as the whipping boy that it sometimes is in Protestant circles in regards to this subject matter. So, one thing that I can tell you that I'm certain of is that we do not today reflect the Philadelphia church as it's described in the letters to the churches. We could be accused, no question, of the ills of both the Sardis and the Laodicean church. But again, we don't fit Philadelphia, unfortunately. So as far as I am concerned, we fit the Laodicean church best. And so what that means is that if we are to interpret this, these letters to the churches in a historical way, to say that it was foreshadowing implicitly the future of the church on earth, then I believe we need to look in the mirror, and I believe that when we do so, we see most likely the Laodicean church. Now, that does not preclude or eliminate a rapture. It only changes the timing, because I would never say that it isn't going to occur, because it's going to occur. It was said too many times. It only says that Jesus will come back for his people once, not twice. And it means that the worldwide trial that is the tribulation that will be inflicted and endured would have to come during the time of the Laodicean church era. Now, we don't doubt that, right? But we, in order to have the pre-trib rapture thought borne out in this context, many people find that they need to say the Philadelphia church is taken away, not going to go through the tribulation. That's fantastic. But guess what? If the tribulation happens during the Laodicean church era, well, That also leaves the Philadelphian church not having to go through that same tribulation. The rapture or the snatching away doesn't have to be the only way that the Philadelphian church avoids this tribulation. So think about that. That's a very important thing. We don't have to have this pre-trib rapture to make this fit if we believe that it is a legitimate argument, this historical interpretation. Now, during the time So again, all that's required is that we accept that this worldwide tribulation and trial will occur during the Laodicean church era, this last church era. And if we indeed are in that era, then these good and easy times, relatively speaking, that we are experiencing will not last. So keep that in mind. But also remember that even the church that Jesus will reject because of its lukewarm condition will have a number that will overcome. Quoting chapter 3, verse 21, John writes, "To him that overcometh will I grant to sit with me in my throne, even as I also overcame and am set down with my Father in his throne." And so there is yet hope. And there is no question that God is going to come back for his people. No doubt the dead in Christ shall rise first. And then those that remain will be changed in a moment, in a twinkling of an eye, and they will be with the Lord forevermore. There is no question about that. But the question is the timing. And so it is easiest for us to accept what we've always thought about as far as the rapture and end times. There's no question that would be great. But I will just say for myself that the Lord doesn't owe me that. He doesn't owe me allowing me to live in these very prosperous times, relatively speaking, not really going through any kind of persecution, and then to snatch me away and have me never have to go through that. Me individually, he does not owe me that. And I am willing that if it is his will for certain of us to have to deal with certain things toward the end of the church age, I have no problem with God's perfect will in that regard. And I know that he is going to come for his people. And I want to be ready if he comes during my lifetime. But I will not hold him to some belief that we may have that all of the church will be removed prior to the tribulation. Because the Laodicean church is a church. It's a church that's not so wonderful, admittedly. But then again, neither are we in many ways from a spiritual standpoint. So in the end, we've got a couple choices. We've got to look in the mirror. And if you look in the mirror as part of this church, and if you evaluate the present day Christian church as fitting more with Philadelphia, okay, no problem. And if the pre-tribulation rapture makes perfect sense to you, and this church that we are experiencing right now deserves to be snatched away, okay. The final judgment will, of course, be God's. But I wanted to put all of this out there for your consumption. I also wanted to avoid you wondering, well, why am I holding out on giving my own personal opinion? I'm telling you from my evaluation of this what my opinion is. My opinion is that we do not fit the Philadelphia description. My opinion is that we fit more either Sardis or Laodicea, but I believe that we've gone past the Sardis time, and clearly we fit the Laodicean description the most. I also believe that it is a very distinct possibility, if not a likelihood, that the rapture, that Jesus coming back for his people, will occur during the Laodicean church era as opposed to before it or just before it. And I personally have no problem with that. And then finally, there is that subject that is certainly an unpopular one, if you put it the way I've been putting it, and that is that maybe, the idea that Jesus will not necessarily come twice for his people, which the pre-tribulation rapture requires, but that Jesus will come once for his people, as is the only thing that's been explicitly stated in the Bible. But the one thing that I will say to my brothers and sisters who are very much believing that Jesus is about to come and rapture his church away, I will just remind you that that's based on a church that had reason to want to be snatched away, had reason to be suffering because of persecution. And so if that is to occur, it's going to get worse before it gets better. There's no question about that. And if the truth be told, the majority of us that want the rapture to occur really are living a life that we don't want to give up. We believe that heaven is a wonderful place, but we're really not anxiously living day to day in the desire to leave this life and this place that we are in. We are not really thinking that to be absent from the body is to be present with the Lord. We're not living on a day-to-day basis wanting to get rid of this place that we're in. Rather, the majority of us are seeking to achieve more of what this world has to offer, not trying to escape from it. But the Philadelphians were not living any such experience. Actually, that experience was reserved for the Laodiceans. And so with that, I'll leave you to each conclude on your own what you think. But at least now you know what I think. And you've got the relevant materials to come to an educated conclusion. And I suppose, finally, if indeed these messages to the churches represent a historical foreshadowing, then as we come on down to these final two churches, Philadelphia and Laodicea, which are relevant for us in our time and our age, then I would see that if it's true, that it serves three realistic constructive purposes. Would serve to encourage those that are part of the Philadelphian church, and if that is us, so be it, and therefore be encouraged. But also it may serve to warn those of the Laodicean era. And so if that is where we are, then we should accept the warnings that are written to the Laodiceans so that we can be awakened from spiritual slumber. And finally, the other thing that it could also serve is to encourage the faithful that are in the Laodicean era, to encourage those who are toiling and believing God despite tremendous risk to themselves in the natural. And so if that's the case as well, so be it. I'm all for it. I just want to be what God wants me to be, no matter what the circumstance is. Well, everyone, with that, I'm going to conclude. I really appreciate the opportunity to have shared another session of Bible study on CD with you. I pray that you have learned a lot, that you have thought a lot, and that you have hopefully come to some conclusions about this historical interpretation of the letters to the churches. Hopefully, I've answered more questions for you than I have created. But if not, please feel free to send any questions that you have my way, and I will be happy to answer them. But as you consider this subject matter, remember that your salvation is not based on anything that we discussed in this session. Regardless of what so-called era we are living in, we will all individually work out our own soul's salvation while we live here on earth. So this is useful in understanding what God is saying through the Bible, but it is not determining your individual salvation. It is not determining whether or not you are taken away when the Lord comes. That you already know what will determine that. You know what's expected of you. Just do remember that it is more than just some one-time confession that God expects. Just you saying that Jesus died on the cross for your sins and you believe that is not adequate. But also remember that, behold, he cometh quickly like a thief in the night. And if you remember that, hopefully that will encourage you to be ready and to stay ready so that when he does come, you can be where you really want to be. Thanks a lot for allowing me to bring you this session. Of course, as always, uncover God's hidden treasure in your lives, and he is so worthy of all of the glory that you can bring to his name and his kingdom. So don't hesitate to give him what he deserves. I'll see you next time. Bye-bye.